ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 3rd of December. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, and the US president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, are meeting Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow. Before the talks, President Putin said Europe's Ukraine peace deal demands were unacceptable, and if it wants to fight, Moscow's ready. Europe correspondent Catherine Diss reports.
In Ukraine's eastern city of Pokrovsk, fighting has been intense. Now, Russia claims it's taken the city. The Kremlin's released an image of two soldiers holding up a flag claiming victory. If true, it would bring this 18-month battle to an end and take Moscow closer to capturing Ukraine's sought-after industrial Donbass region. Kyiv denies the victory, but Russian President Vladimir Putin is digging in.
Apparently, the question who controls Pokrovsk emerges in connection with persisting doubts. Is it really so? If someone still has doubts, as we already said, and I suggested this too, that your colleagues, the international and even Ukrainian media, we are ready to grant this right to the Ukrainian journalists to visit the city of Pokrovsk and witness with their own eyes what is going on over there. Who really controls this settlement?
The timing's important. Moscow's demanding the Donbass as a condition to signing a peace deal, capturing the city in the midst of high-stake talks at the Kremlin with US officials would be a propaganda coup and fuel the argument Russia is winning on the battlefield. Away from the front line and at the negotiating table in Moscow.
So pleased to see you.
US Special Envoy Steve Witkoff sits opposite the Russian president, accompanied by Donald Trump's son-in-law and advisor, Jared Kushner. After 2 days of talks with Ukrainian officials in Florida, Mr. Witkoff is hoping he'll get Vladimir Putin to compromise on some of his war-ending demands. But just before the talks got underway, the Russian president took a hostile tone.
We are not planning to fight Europe. I have said this 100 times. But if Europe suddenly decides to wage war against us and starts it, we are ready right now.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was on a state visit to Ireland. He said security guarantees for Ukraine were in the latest iteration of the peace plan, but the detail was still being fine-tuned.
First of all, I want to say that there will be no easy solutions. We understand what is happening. We understand who we are dealing with.
But there won't be any peace deal if Moscow doesn't agree. And for now, both sides appear worlds apart. This is Catherine Diss reporting for AM.
As floodwaters recede, the Indonesian island of Sumatra is discovering the devastation wrought by last week's floods and landslides. Large parts of Southeast Asia are still reeling after a series of cyclones and storm systems lashed the region. At least 700 people have been killed in Indonesia, with hundreds still missing. Indonesia correspondent Tim Swanston filed this report from Langkat in North Sumatra.
Surveying what's left of her village in North Sumatra, Siti Nurbaya Sitagar feels lucky she and her family survived last week's powerful flooding. Half of the homes in her small village in Langkat were completely torn apart by floodwaters, including her own house.
I'm very sad because the place where I lived from childhood has gone. All my belongings that I use every day are all gone in the mud.
Cyclone Senya, an unusual cyclone that formed last week in the Malacca Strait near the equator, dumped torrential rain across parts of Southeast Asia, with the island of Sumatra hit extremely hard. The heavy rains triggered widespread landslides and flash flooding. Residents had to be rescued by boat after fast-flowing floodwater rose up through homes. Siti Nurbaya Sitagar and her family had to climb onto their roof for safety before help arrived.
I was rescued by my neighbour on a tiny boat. It was loaded with my children, my mum, other relatives. Altogether, there were 7 people. The boat almost flipped over on the way to the rescue point.
Nearby, many families are sheltering at a mosque by the side of a road. Some can't get back to their homes, and others have no homes to return to. More than 1 million people have been displaced by the floods and landslides, with an urgent operation underway to deliver aid to communities, especially those that are cut off. But many here at this centre feel the response has been inadequate and they feel abandoned. Here's Rosmita, a mother who was staying at the makeshift shelter.
We don't have food, we don't have medical supplies, and the children are sick.
Across the three provinces of Aceh, North Sumatra and West Sumatra, road access, power and phone reception is slowly being restored, but some communities remain isolated. Rescue crews are also digging through enormous landslides to find bodies, with hundreds of people still missing. There have been growing calls for Indonesia's President Prabowo Subianto to declare a national state of emergency to bolster the relief efforts on the ground. He's so far resisted those calls, but in a visit to Sumatra, he said governments needed to safeguard the environment and prepare for extreme weather. Siti Nurbaya Sirigar's brother, Arisan, wants the president to do more.
President Prabowo, please help us because our homes have been wiped out.
This is Tim Swanston in Langkat, North Sumatra, reporting for AM.
Former Defence Force personnel say the timing of a new inquiry into sexual violence within the Australian Defence Force is curious, pointing out a major class action against the ADF has just been launched. New details about the range of the inquiry have been revealed a year after the Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicide uncovered extensive evidence of sexual assaults. Here's political reporter Samantha Dick.
Bec McGaw says she was just 17 years old when she was sexually assaulted by a male colleague at Air Force recruit training.
I expressed to my chain that I didn't want to be anywhere near him and what he did, but nothing really happened.
With the announcement of an independent inquiry examining sexual violence in the Australian Defence Force, Ms. McGaw says she wants senior ADF members, not just the perpetrators, held to account.
There are so many members that are a part of chain of commands of these perpetrators that help hide, that don't do the right thing by completing investigations or reporting to protect their colleagues, juniors or mates.
Shadow Assistant Minister for Defence Phil Thompson agrees that those in power who fail to crack down on abuse should not be let off lightly.
Whilst they're not the perpetrator, that's just as bad in my view by making someone feel like they can't speak out.
The inquiry was a recommendation of the Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicide. Associate Professor James Connor, an expert in institutional abuse within the ADF at the University of New South Wales, was called to appear as an expert witness.
Too often the decision was made to not investigate or to not then charge, and of course then there's no accountability.
The inquiry's terms of reference include probing the effectiveness of the ADF's own military justice system and investigating why victims are reluctant to report incidents of sexual assault. While Ms. McGaw is hopeful the inquiry will lead to change, she has questions over the government's timing, given the recent launch of a major class action against the ADF, alleging widespread sexual harassment and abuse.
This could have been announced within the last 12 months of the Royal Commission recommendations. However, they're only releasing this now after a class action. I just think it's a very suspicious timing.
Her concerns about the politics are shared by Mr. Thompson, a Liberal MP who served in Afghanistan.
It's clearly about trying to show they're doing something without really doing anything for quite some time, because it doesn't start till, middle of next year?
Minister for Veterans Affairs Matt Keogh has rejected those claims, saying the government is rolling out the Royal Commission's recommendations in an orderly manner, with 32 recommendations due to be implemented by the end of the month.
We've placed so much urgency on getting these recommendations done, but it was important to stage them properly as well. That's why we were looking at the inquiry occurring in 2026 and why we're keen to get draft terms of reference out this year.
Associate Professor Connor says the ADF can start by clearly outlining its progress in responding to the Royal Commission and by investing in cultural change.
Just as much as you would resource making sure we have the best rifles, tanks, ships, planes, etc. for our serving personnel, we should make sure we resource the best training and leadership and support for the people to make sure that culture is no longer what it was.
Associate Professor James Connor, an expert in institutional abuse within the ADF, ending that report by Samantha Dick. Fresh NEPLAN results for 10,000 schools are out, showing how students are performing with reading, writing and maths. From today, parents can also check their school's progress compared with other similar institutions on the My School website. The curriculum assessment body, known as ACARA, has uploaded the data and listed 50 high-performing schools in each state and territory. So what's the secret sauce for well-performing schools? Here's National Education reporter Connor Duffy.
And you guys have been amazing, and that's why you are kicking lots of goals.
It's Year 5 maths time at Springvale Rise Primary School, a school in Melbourne that's low on privilege but high on performance. It's been named as one of the finest schools in Australia, with roughly two-thirds of its students making above-average progress in reading, writing and numeracy. 93% of students are from non-English-speaking backgrounds and almost 80% from disadvantaged backgrounds.
Springvale Rise Primary School is a really culturally diverse community, so a lot of our families are of a refugee-type background.
It's a proud moment for Principal Debbie Cottier.
Many have come from Burma, from Myanmar. Their journeys are wide and varied. A lot of those families haven't had education themselves.
Principal Cottier attributes the school's success to a focus on explicit teaching, using data to spot knowledge gaps, and a commitment to building a great culture.
We genuinely have that really high expectations. We create an environment where kids want to come to school. We are so proud, and the joy that you see from our families when they hear about the successes that we're making is really inspiring.
About 900 kilometres away on Sydney's affluent North Shore, Chatswood Public School is another celebrated as making a difference. The common thread is systematic, consistent, explicit teaching and the use of data to spot and reverse gaps in knowledge before kids fall behind. Principal Cameron Jones is also proud. 60% of students made above average progress in literacy and numeracy between years 3 and 5.
Research shows that if we can narrow the gap of achievement within year 3, that makes a huge difference to what students achieve in year 12.
National NAPLAN figures released in July raised concerns about the performance of Australian students, with roughly one-third not meeting challenging but reasonable expectations. Education analyst and former teacher Tricia Jar says the explicit teaching powering Springvale Rise and Chatswood is the secret sauce for success.
It would be difficult to point out an example of a school that has had a quick and a sustained improvement in its student results without using explicit instruction approaches.
As well as individual school performance, the Australian Curriculum Assessment and Reporting Authority, ACARA, has released school attendance data. ACARA CEO Stephen Gneil says it shows a small improvement in 2025, with attendance up 88.1%, but still well below the pre-pandemic figure of 91.4%.
Kids learn when they're at school, and you've got to be there to do that. So, we're really encouraged by that direction, but I think, like all parents and, you know, our community at large, we want to see higher attendance rates.
ACARA Chief Executive Stephen Gneil speaking there with Connor Duffy. While summer's just started, the bushfire season's already bringing destruction, with separate fires killing a farmer and destroying at least one home in Western Australia. Events like this can have a big impact on children and teenagers. From next year, the Youth Mental Health Foundation Headspace will work with schools across the country to better prepare young people for disasters and support them in the aftermath. Isabel Misali reports.
Cormor Public School in southeastern New South Wales survived the devastating Black Summer bushfires. But here, many students lost their homes.
A lot of the kids had a lot of thoughts after the fire they couldn't unpack. And they were a little bit traumatised in not knowing how to express themselves.
That's Principal Daniel Rowe. He noticed a difference in how children managed in the aftermath of the disaster.
Families that struggled were the families who already had complex lives, and you could clearly see particular students who found it hard to regulate their behaviour, who were dysregulated a lot more easily.
It's hoped that primary and high school students right across Australia will soon be better prepared for disasters and supported through them. Youth mental health organisation Headspace has been awarded $9 million in federal funding to run an $11 million program over 3 years. It'll kick off next month, with the rollout determined by the risk of disaster at each school. Here's CEO Jason Chithawan.
A lot of it will be group work together with students in classrooms, learning together, being with each other, really fostering that social connection, because what we have seen is that when children and young people feel part of a room, feel part of a class, they can actually take on some of these more, maybe some nuanced, difficult conversations about handle their emotions and how to regulate them.
Schools will be given guidelines and support strategies, while workshops will be run with educators and school leaders. The goal is to create a more nationally consistent framework.
When something does happen, then at least we've got something that the school will be familiar with, and that's when Headspace would actually provide some more intensive support, but at the pace by which the school needs to move.
I was really excited to see the announcement.
Psychologist Michelle Roberts is an expert on child and adolescent trauma and disaster recovery. She explains recovery is often effective when the child is physically, emotionally and psychologically prepared.
There's a lot of good programs in existence that are helping young people and children to be prepared, but there's not enough. And I think people are often shying away from preparing kids because they think that it's too frightening. The kids tell me they want to know more and they want to be prepared.
Back at Cormer Public School, Principal Daniel Rowe wants ongoing support for counselling, but he believes the new program will make a difference.
It's reassuring to know that there's some proactive policies out there that are ready to go if and when any disasters do happen in the future. So, yeah, it's good to know.
School Principal Daniel Rowe, ending that report by Isabel Masali and Adrian Reardon. The Gaza ceasefire is now beyond its seventh week. Israeli forces are continuing to launch strikes in the territory, claiming it's enforcing the truce and targeting Hamas for violating the deal. Yet amid all the ongoing devastation, there's been a ray of hope and excitement overnight, with more than 50 Palestinian couples officially tying the knot in a mass wedding ceremony in the territory's south. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports.
After 2 years of war, cause for celebration. As thousands of Palestinians crammed into a square in Khan Yunis to catch a glimpse of a very important day. People scrambled to secure whatever vantage point they could reach, even climbing over the crumbled ruins of buildings to watch the spectacle. 29-year-old Omar Shams is one of the grooms.
I was engaged before the war. I wanted to marry during the war, but all my belongings were destroyed and there was no possibility to get married.
The brides wore matching white gowns with detailed red and gold embroidery, the grooms matching suits with maroon ties. The newlyweds and many others in the rather informal congregation witnessing the nuptials carried the flags of Palestine and the United Arab Emirates, a major aid donor to Gaza, helping to fund the mass wedding. With drummers and dancers on stage and those gathered to watch sitting on plastic chairs or simply standing in the dusty street, this may not have been exactly the special day these couples had dreamed of. But some feared it may never arrive at all due to the recent deadly bombardment. 17-year-old Adim Eid is one of the brides, finding joy in the midst of desperation.
Before the war, I was engaged and we lived in a house. And now I'm going to live in a tent in the middle of the destruction and pain that we live in.
The ceasefire has given an opportunity for events like this to happen, along with school and university graduations. But even though the truce is technically in force, Israeli strikes have not stopped. The military insists it's enforcing the deal. Another two Palestinians Israel claimed to be Hamas militants killed after crossing the so-called yellow line between Israeli and Hamas-controlled territory. Palestinian health authorities say more than 350 people have been killed and more than 900 injured since the ceasefire began. Three Israeli soldiers have been killed in the same period, and so far the remains of 26 of 28 dead Israeli hostages have been returned, with more remains handed over to Israel overnight. But for 32-year-old groom Nail Musa, today is one of happiness.
We are a people that deserves to celebrate, and at the same time a people that doesn't want to openly rejoice because of what's happened to us. Most of us are a family with someone in prison, someone wounded, or someone who's been killed. But we're obliged to celebrate after 2 years of what we've lived through.
This is Matthew Doran in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
And that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hello, I'm Sydney Peed from ABC News Daily podcast. Australian property is now more expensive than ever, and soaring mortgage debt has the financial regulator hitting the brakes on risky lending. Today, Ian Verinder on why APRA is targeting property investors and whether it could finally offer some relief for house hunters. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.